This week, I've got two guests. I know I usually have maybe one or possibly two, but this week I've got two guests. They are Jean Gordon and Jane Robinson. Welcome to Writer's Block.
Thank you very much.
Good evening.
Lovely. And both your mics are working perfectly. So that's brilliant. So you're both members of the Brightling Sea Youth 3A. So how did that come about for you both? Let's start with you, Jane.
Well, I became a member because I was friends with Penny Yule, who it was chairman at the time. And the U3A is designed for people who are now in part-time work or retirement, and just to bring all those skills together. So I joined because I was interested in being occupied and doing various bits and pieces. So that's how I joined the U3A. But the project itself was developed by... the origins go back to 2012, in actual fact, when we were given a talk by the Pioneer Sailing Trust about this particular boat that they had restored and were using for young people. And the passing comment was, well, we'd quite like to know what clothing they were wearing. So the idea was shared, caught the imagination of a number of members, and... between us, we brought a variety of interests, skills and experience to the project, which, after all those years, has culminated in a book. But we'll tell you more about our journey and our story, how we got there, a little bit later.
Right. Well, that's actually, I mean, straight away, there's so much information that's so exciting. You know, you joined it for one reason. I'll say you got pulled into a group. That's not quite the way it was. And out of that, a book has happened. That's great, isn't it?
Well, the book was not the idea. The idea was that we just wanted to do some research to find out what these fishermen who were away for about 3 to 4 weeks crossing the North Sea up to Northern Holland, what they were actually wearing while they were on the boat during the winter months, because this is when they went. And we had no idea. You can find a lot of information about what wealthy people wore, but not necessarily about what working people. So we decided there were some questions that we needed to answer. What would the seafarers have worn for, you know, winter deep sea conditions? What fabrics would have been available? And could the same materials or their modern equivalents be sourced so that we could actually see about making those particular garments? Were there patterns for knitting and sewing these garments? And what materials and recipes were used for rot and weatherproofing of the materials?
Gosh, it's so much, isn't there? Jean, right, tell me a moment. Sorry, I'm pulling my mic over here. Tell me how you got involved with the U3A.
Well, I was a carer for my husband for 3 years and housebound virtually with him. And when he passed away, I just knew that I had to get out into the community and find something of interest. So I went to one of the speakers' meetings down in our local council offices, which I knew was a U3A meeting, and had the speaker. And then somebody stood up and asked if anybody would be interested in knitting. Well, I'd been a knitter all my life, and I thought this could be a nice way of just making friends, getting into things. So I volunteered to do a little bit of knitting, maybe the front of a jumper, a sleeve, who knows, just something as part of a sweater. But as you'll go on to find out, it turned out that the sweater was knitted in one piece and I was landed with knitting the whole sweater. But I did make friends.
As I mentioned to you earlier off air, that I can knit a scarf and I can knit a blanket, but knitting a jumper in one piece, that's a challenge.
Quite a challenge, very much so, especially in dark wool and very fine wool and very long needles. So yes, a challenge. But as I say, I was in the group before I knew it, and there was a nice group, all friendly, all made me welcome, and I just kept knitting. That's all there was.
I've gone through some of these questions with you already, so you know what to expect, but I will throw a few more in. Would you do it again?
Yes, I think we would, actually, because the interest that has been created by doing it and the skills that all of us have enhanced and increased and shared is what life is all about. And if somebody were to say, oh yes, could we do this? We have got another project with this to go on later on, but Yes, we would. Well, I certainly would.
Can I just... I would not knit another Guernsey, no.
At least you're honest.
I am. I would not do another one. It really played havoc with my wrists in the end, and it was a lot of knitting, so no, I would not.
But you can tick the box to say you've actually done that.
Absolutely.
So let's ask you both, actually. How did the idea for Oysters and Oilskins, which is a brilliant title, by the way, materialise within the group?
Well, the original idea was to just carry out some research to find out what they were wearing. Then we realised we had a lot of skills, so we thought we would then make the whole set of clothing, which is what we did. Then the chairman of the group, really, a lady called Penny Yule, who's a brilliant researcher, turned around and said, well, we've got all this information. Let's see if we can collate it originally into a pamphlet. It was just going to be a little bit of an information leaflet. It grew and grew, and we realised that we had some amazing photographs, we had some amazing interest. We also found that it started to become of a social interest to what we were researching, so not just Brightlingsea, but coastal, east coastal fishermen. And we realised we could actually put this into a book. Fortunately, we had some book publishers in Brightlingsea, Redbird Publishers, who helped us with the layout and the format, so we had guidance as to where we were going, and had no idea that we would actually finish up with a publication that you could put into your hand and you could read and you could dip in and out. So it appeals to a number of different people. It appeals to people that are good old smack sailors, the old traditional smacks and fishing vessels. It also appeals to people who want to have some interest about the social history of what was going on in the area. But it also appeals to those costumers, people who are interested in clothing, who are interested in how things were made, what materials were being used. So in the book itself, if you're interested in the actual making and costumes, the pages have got a cream background on them. So you can dip into the book and find out your specific interests rather than, like anything, start from the beginning and get bored halfway through. So it is designed there for a different number of variety of people who might have that interest.
That's a brilliant, you know, to be so forward-thinking about the readers, you know, necessity, the reader's needs, and actually different readers, because, as you say, it's going to be so many different people are going to be looking at this book. So it's very, I mean, who came up with that? Was that in one of your meetings? You just thought an idea?
Yes, it was. We had regular, sort of every sort of 6 weeks or so, we would have all get together, but obviously modern communications through emails and things that we would do that. And it just, I can't remember how it came about, but we just said, well, yes, let's do this.
It's a really good idea.
It's proved to be an excellent idea. And I, you know, can sit here with a book in front of me. I can browse it and see what parts that are of interest. I can't remember who thought of the idea, but there's eight of us in the group itself, bringing together all sorts of different skills to produce what we have done. So whether or not we, as I say, sewers, knitters, we were all doing a bit of research. I think the most exciting thing for all of us was actually carrying out the research. You found one thing, then it led on to another thing and another thing. And also making sure, Penny was absolutely rigorous, write down where you got the information, of course, where yes. it came from. So within the book, there is a very detailed bibliography right. of exactly where we found everything. Mm-hmm. So that if people want to use the book as the beginnings of research, they can take those references and carry them on further in whichever way they'd like to do so.
Yeah, I'm smiling here like crazy because I'm just about to start the final year of a degree and I'm just reading through the module introduction and there's so many notes that say about why referencing is important, but I think, oh God, and now you've mentioned it as well, and I'm thinking, oh God, it's still these notes, and you know, still in my head. Jean, now you took on the majority of the knitting,
yes,
and a couple of people helped with the knitting as well. From your point of view, how much time did that take you?
The Guernsey took an awful lot of time, and because I needed the light to do it, then I was working early in the mornings. in my conservatory to get the light. So I made myself do almost an hour every day, because it was one of those things where it grew so slowly, you just kept thinking, I just got to keep plugging away at this, plugging away. And then, of course, the top is patterned in cable stitches, so that had to be learnt and worked through. And then I took on the sea boot stockings and a balaclava. But that was interesting, because we got those patterns out of really old books from the 1880s and 1900s, you know. And to go back, although I do modern, obviously I knit myself jumpers, but to go back and look at that and work with different wools, I found that very interesting. Yeah, gosh, it's been a real good experience.
I know you said earlier on you wouldn't actually do one of those again.
No, that's correct. So I don't want any orders. No, I'm not doing one.
We'll try our best not to.
I know, I've tried. People have tried, but the answer is no.
When you, with every other type of knitting that you do, do you still do that since then?
Yeah, I've just finished a jumper for myself.
Right.
Yeah,
I was just going to say, is it a relief?
Yes. Absolutely.
To get back to what you're used to.
Yes, very much so.
It play havoc with your hands?
It does. It plays havoc with your wrists in the end, yeah. And you start getting, you know, maybe a start of arthritis or something. Just the continuous. How the women got on to doing one for the son, one for the father, and doing a couple of Ganses, I do not know.
No.
I don't know how they did it. It's amazing.
And you've got some pictures in the book as well with people knitting. As you mentioned earlier about they were doing it outside because they wouldn't have had the light to do it inside.
That's a really good bit
of research, isn't it? If you're going to be writing about, you know, that era and knitting, you know, would that be something that you'd have to look and find out, because we wouldn't necessarily think about it straight away?
Well, it was just identified that there was lots of pictures of people knitting outside, and then you realise that they didn't have electric light. Cottages were thick-walled, you know, to keep cool or heat in, and so therefore they knitted outside. But one of the things I'd like to mention, which Jean hasn't mentioned about the Ganses, is she mentioned about the cabling, that a lot of different areas, particularly along the East Coast, had specific patterns in their Ganses for that particular area. Because when, and families also had particular patterns, so that if a person was lost their lives overboard or were lost at sea, their bodies could be identified by the pattern on the Ganzi.
Gosh.
Or if they didn't have a specific pattern, they would often have their initials knitted into that particular Ganzi. So that there isn't a particular pattern for Brightening Sea, but we got one as locally as we possibly could. Mm. But it becomes quite interesting when you start to look at the reasoning behind the cables are about ropes and lines, and all the patterns have some reason of history about what they say.
It's regional and symbolic.
Yeah.
Identification. Yeah. Well, that's quite touching, actually, isn't it?
And they were so proud of them that even if there was a wedding, they would actually, you know, could actually wear their Ganses to weddings and you know, big events, because they were just a piece of artwork, really, then. Yeah. Amazing, yeah. Really,
well, you said earlier about how difficult it was, how challenging it was to actually knit it. I would think they were probably saying to him, you're going to wear that for every day.
Absolutely.
I've knitted that for you. You're going to wear
it.
So that's the research part of the book and the actual creating of the clothing as well. The other part of the book as well, the putting together, the formatting, how did you go about that part?
It started off basically by just writing on A4 sheets. You know, we were just using the Word and compiling. Each one of us sort of put together. For instance, I was particularly doing a lot of work with the trousers. So each one of us sort of put the words together of how what we wanted to say. It then went to Penny, who then started to make sure and check and referencing and proofread. I don't know about anybody else, but if I've ever written anything, I cannot proofread it. And some people are very, very good at proofreading. I'm not. Other people are. So again, we looked at the different skills, so somebody we'd pass that on and read it and see where it was going. We then, as I say, through our contacts with Redbird Publishing, who could take the Word document, put it into a PDF, then put it into a publishing file. So the biggest problem, believe it or not, was to decide on what size the book was going to be. What shape was it going to be? And we had all sorts of different examples and thought, well, we don't want it too big. We don't want it too small. The other big problem was deciding what colour were we going to make the jacket. So it's actual fact quite a sort of yellowy colour. So that it could be distinguished amongst another pile of books. So there was a lot of debate, a lot of toing and throwing. The I'm right, Jean, correct me, one of our members, it was her son, Stu, or son-in-law, who is a great formatter and...
Pauline's brother-in-law.
Let's get it right.
Yeah. Stuart
designed the front cover.
Right.
So we took... There's an old picture of a Wivenhoe man, believe it or believe it not, some modern photographs of some of the other members of the U3A who modelled the clothing on the Pioneer. And that was how he, because he could put it together, that's how we managed to get our front page. So it wasn't one person.
No, very much.
I can't explain the collaborative. So the photography group in the U3A, all right, came out on the Pioneer, put the clothes on and took a lot of the photographs that depict the clothing actually on the Pioneer.
I was going to ask you about the models, yes.
Yeah, so that was another group within the U3A who weren't particularly interested in the making or the research that we did to produce this, but were very interested in producing good quality photographs. Another super gentleman called John Carr, who was a very good, has been a professional photographer in his own right, is a Breitling Seaman, again, helped collate a lot of the photographs. He helped format a lot of the scanning pictures that we had so that they were in a manner that could be published without being distorted. So all free of charge. All this
We were very lucky to find these people that were willing to help us and to come along to give their time and not charge us, as you say.
Yeah.
Even the publisher, Redbird, did not charge us because it was Breitling Sea.
Very good.
And I can't emphasise the collaboration between the different organisations that we've had. Plus also the Pioneer Sailing Trust, who are an organisation that do a lot of boat building, and they rebuilt the Pioneer. And the Pioneer is a huge 60-foot skillinger, as is its correct word. And they take disaffected and disadvantaged young people out, sometimes just for the day, sometimes for the week. In actual fact, we had a group of those that were involved with the production of the book had a sale on Pioneer last Monday as a thank you to say, well, come on, you can all, those of you that were some of the models, and even Stu who did the front cover came, and they could have a sale on the boat to just actually get the feel of what they were doing. And so it's that collaboration. This isn't one person. This isn't Jean and Jane producing this book. This was eight people within a group. One of those people has moved from the area. But it's all those that spiralled out from it that came in and started to be interested in what we did. So I can't emphasise the collaboration in putting it all together. There were lots of tos and fros. I mean, the piles of paper, the amount of times that we read it, we discard it. The biggest problem, funnily enough, was getting permission to use the photographs.
Oh, okay, yeah.
So some of the photographs were far too expensive to get the permission to use. Others, some like photographs from Cromer Museum, Mersey Museum, etc., fine, no problems at all. And that's all referenced in the book to say thank you to those museums. But we ensured that we had credit for every single photograph that we used so that there was no copyright infringement in anything that we were doing. Mm-hmm. And that was a jolly hard task, but was an important task if you're going to produce a publication.
Yes, absolutely.
And I think we've learned that now. If we go into anything else with the food and what we're looking at in the future, I think that's so important to us now that every bit of information that you gather has got to be logged and listed and where and why and... Yes.
That's definitely been a really good opportunity to find out for the future.
Exactly,
hasn't it?
A learning curve again for something, you know, something I've never been involved in before, and it is a bit, you know, a really good learning curve, definitely.
And the essence is community, isn't it?
Very much so, yes.
I'm glad you came on Community Radio then to talk about it. So we were talking off air a moment ago about how important skills in life are and how we often overlook them, actually. So the skills that you've managed to bring together within the group that you've also been part of, but also the U3A, that's worth a mention.
Oh, I think it's a multitude of different skills. I mean, let's just broaden it out for a minute about the U3A. I mean, in Brightening Sea, we have different groups. There's a photography group, there's a Scrabble group, there's an art appreciation, there's a music group. There's a walking group, there's a strollers, there's an antique group, there's a craft and craft group. Jean, help me out here.
We've got 23 different groups. Whether they be luncheon groups, which is more of the social side, or the two walking groups, the strollers and the striders, or the as Jane says, Scrabble groups. So they're more the social side, where we have got other groups where, you know, you can learn, or I actually run an antiques and collectibles group. So we do go out and look at people's, you know, collections of different things. We've just, one of our members is a coin collector, which I never knew, so we've just done that. So there are skills and things out there that are absolutely amazing.
I'm surprised you had time to create a book.
Well,
I mean,
Jean runs the antique and collectibles, I run the craft group. So then you have all these skills and you suddenly say, oh, well, I can do this, I can do that. But the most important thing is about building people's confidence, to have that ability to say, well, I'll have a go, I'll do something. And it's quite interesting to watch people who become very, very hesitant about something. But I'll give you an example. I was running the family history group a few years ago, and I realised that I had to create a certain subject every month. And I would research the subject and then we'd discuss it. And then I was sitting down and saying, well, Les, what subjects are we going to do for next winter? And the group turned around and said, well, I could research that and present that. I could do that one. If I had turned round and said that right at the very beginning, they'd have said, no, I can't do that. I can't do that. And the thrill of being able to see somebody having the confidence to say, yes, I'll do it. And so this is what's happened within the group of the clothing project, was that we came together with such a wide variety of different skills. But as it all came together, it was cohesive and coherent in producing something, Oysters and Oilskins, the book in the end. I can't tell you the different journeys that everybody had, because we'd still be needing to have a little bit of coffee at about midnight. But if we actually understood how, like, there's one particular lady now who's concentrating on our eBay sales, we'll come on to where it is, but she wasn't very IT.
Okay.
Didn't know how to do it, was a very hesitant. But we've built those skills. She said, oh yes, I can do that now. And that's fantastic. But if you were to write it down on a book and say, oh, well, this person has got this skill, this person has got that skill, this person needs this skill to be developed or what. Yeah. No, everybody would run away.
Yeah, it's too much like a school report.
Yeah. This is about just people coming together, initially talking, listening, which is the important factor, and finding out how they can develop. And suddenly you say, well, actually, I'll have a go at that.
We even found out we had catering skills. You were kind enough to come along to our book launch, and we did that all ourselves. We catered for, hopefully, we thought 30 to 40 people. And we did, you've just admitted yourself,
it was
we did
really nice.
A very, very nice buffet. And everybody did comment on it. But that was just all of us getting together, deciding who was going to do what, so sweet, savoury, and it just worked out.
It wasn't only, it wasn't only what you'd created, it was how you presented it as well. Yeah. That went into it huge.
Yes, well, we gave that some thought as well. It was all thought about. It happened at the Pioneer Sheds itself, which was a nice venue. everything was out on display. So yes, and again, we found out that we could cater if we needed to as a sideline.
You just said thank you for coming. Well, thank you for inviting me. Right, let's talk a little bit about the underwear and the overwear of the clothing.
Yeah, I mean, when we talk about clothing, we often assume it's just outerwear. But we wanted to know what they wore right close to their skin, right the way through to the outerwear. Now, believe it or believe it not, gentlemen, they didn't have underpants. Ooh. That was the most interesting thing. What they wore was a big long shirt that tucked forward and aft, okay, basically. And a lot of it was made out of wool or brushed cotton to a certain extent. So we managed to produce these undervests, and we found out previously that sometimes, not that the people on the Pioneer used them, but quite often they had pockets in and were used for smugglers for tobacco and bits, ooh, and pieces. So that was quite interesting.
That's another book, isn't it?
It is another book, yeah. And then we produced shirts. Then we came across lovely words like slops, doppers and roppers. And you think, well, what on earth in the world is that? But a slop is a canvas top that quite often went over the Guernsey that was actually waterproofed. It was a short one. That one came down to about just below the thigh level. But the dopper is a much longer one. That one came right the way down to below the knees. And a ropper is a scarf that goes round the neck. Now, if you think about it, we actually found that they wore little cufflets. And you often see the old sort of sailors with a scarf round their neck. And you think, why? Well, if you think these guys were at sea for at least 3 weeks, getting wet, getting cold, the salt. And what happened is, after a period of time, their outer clothing, or even their underclothing, would become quite encrusted with salt, and therefore it would chafe.
Right.
So therefore they needed the scarves and the little wristlets to stop the clothing chafing. So we then produced, as I say, Guernseys, the slops. We then decided that we would have this big dopper, which was the waterproof bit, which is made out of canvas. And to proof it, we used linseed oil. So you would put this linseed oil on. Now, if anybody is familiar with linseed, it has a couple of properties. It's quite flammable, believe it or not.
Gosh.
So you don't want to leave it inside, or you don't want to leave a rag screwed up. And it has an interesting aroma. So we covered this particular dopper with linseed oil, and it was in one of the team's sheds, Pauline's shed. And over a period of time, it went darker and darker and darker, to the point where it was quite yellow. And that's where the origins of the old yellow oilskins come from.
Okay.
By the linseed oil turning yellow and yellow. When we did a bit of research about how they proofed their clothing, like the slop, we came across some amazing recipes that used it, horse fat and urine, various different bleaches and colours and different fats. And we had a little bit of an experiment in Pauline's kitchen with Kutch and everything else, boiling all this stuff up to see could create the proofing. Because that's how they tanned the big sails. So when they tanned and proofed the big sails, it was also used on the clothing. Well, the slop that we actually finished up doing is actually been proofed with fence paint, because that's what they use today. And because the clothing was actually going to be used by children and other adults to try on, we couldn't actually have something that was full of urine and horse fat and various other ingredients that we don't want to mention. So we managed to produce that. The most exciting thing also with the outer garment is you'll see pictures of people with a funny-looking bobble hat on, with a hat with a knot in the top, which is the origins of the old bobble hat. Well, when they just wanted to put a hat just on top of the ears, they would take the top and tie a knot so it fitted properly. Okay. When they wanted it to pull down right completely, they would undo the knot and pull it down a little bit further. So there are lots of pictures of sailors with these funny little hats with the knot in the top, and that's how it came about. And we actually, we couldn't find a pattern for those, could we, Jean?
No,
we couldn't. So. So therefore, it was quite interesting. It was Jean and another lady, Patricia, who decided, oh, well, I think we could manage to knit it, and took some of the yarn that was used for the Guernseys and decided to produce the hats. So again, another skill, thinking, yeah, we can do that.
The designer as well.
The designer. So we can do it. The other most fascinating thing is the boots these fishermen wore. And if you, again, if you looked at the pictures, you'll see that they wore lovely, big, long leather thigh boots. Wow. Now,
I feel there's a butt coming out.
Well, yes, in that they were one of the most expensive and most precious commodities that they could ever have. We managed to find a film called Fish and Ships, which was done by Channel, am I allowed to say, Channel 4, some time ago. And they had a bootmaker guy called Mr. Beebe, who had made recreated boots. We contacted him, but to actually have him to recreate, we couldn't have the skills to do it, was far too expensive. But we did have Pauline had a friend who produced garments and boots for reenactments, and she produced a pair of boots for us. The interesting thing about these is the soles of these boots, that they're held together with beech pegs. Because, one, if you just had leather as the soles, it would be slippery on the decks. Right. You couldn't put metal studs in because they would rust with the sea water. But the wood would swell slightly and hold, in the first place, the soles of the boots together, and also help as an adhesive on the deck so they didn't slip.
Gosh.
And then you see pictures of ends with the... with these long boots, and they would roll them down so they were soft on top. So this was with their long dopper and their sea boots. Hopefully the water would come down the dopper and onto the boots to try and keep them dry.
As much as possible.
As much as possible. Wasn't always easy.
No, if there's a storm, yeah.
Yeah. And some of us are sailors here. Jean and I are both sailors. And yes, we have been on the foredeck when the big greens come down your neck, and it's, you know, been there, done one, that one, tick that box, and not going to do it again.
Right.
Thank you.
Do you think you'd wear that clothing?
Not at sea, no.
Not by choice.
But it was the most important thing we have to remember, and we haven't said this, is that these guys were poor. They actually wore what they could get hold of.
Right.
They didn't actually go out and buy specific clothing to go to sea with. This was what was available. This was what maybe their families or their wives, girlfriends had made for them. And one of the other points is that particularly in this particular area, Brightling Sea produces some very famous sailors. I mentioned earlier that they went to sea during the winter. So obviously during the summer, what did they do? A lot of them crewed for the big J-class racing yachts that were about at that particular time. So they were transferring their skills to other boats. And quite often, when they were crewing, they were issued with a jumper or a Guernsey that had the boat's name across the top.
Wow.
So in many pictures, again, you'll see people pride of place with the boat's name coming across. And we actually we purchased this particular jumper, but we hand-stitched the name Priscilla on the front to identify that these were the sort of clothings that they would have worn.
Gosh.
And just to go back of interest to say the transferable skills, Brightling Sea is a great source of various interest, and there's another very good book which compares the 1880 and the 1890 census. And in 1890, which is the period we're talking about, there were 345 mariners in Brightling Sea. There were a few oyster fishermen. There were a few sailors. There were a few boat builders. But basically, they were mariners, which meant that they were using their skills in a vast different areas like fishing, boat building, oyster fishing, racing, crewing, so that they were men of the sea and they were well and truly mariners.
Gosh. So where can people or listeners, where can they get hold of this book?
Right, there are a number of places. One is the Red Lion Bookshop in Colchester, Wivenhoe Bookshop. Little Boat Gifts in Brightlingsea, Spirals in Brightlingsea, and if you would like to search Oysters and Oilskins, you can get it from eBay. The cost is £9.99, and all the money now goes to the Pioneer Sailing Trust.
Wonderful, thank you. Would you like to read out the foreword?
I'm going to read the foreword written by Libby Purvis. Sailing along our bleak, fascinating, ever-changing, swirling and perilous East Coast purely for pleasure, it is sobering to think of those for whom, all year round, it is a workplace. From our wind-steadied sailing yacht, we see the plunging, rolling trawlers and the figures on board working with hoists and nets, and pay them due respect. But more sobering still to reflect that long before our high-tech fleeces and magically breathable, flexible, high-vis offshore gear, their fishing ancestors did the same job. With less machinery, in Guernseys and oilcloth, clothes that grew heavy with salt water and oilskin stiff as boards. But fashion history, loving the silks and the velvets and sprigged muglins of romantic Victorian bonnet drama, has perhaps never paid enough attention to the fascinating question of what ingenuities and preferences and sheer financial practicalities govern the outfits of working people. The Pioneer Clothing Project decided to do this and does it with rigour and fascination and wonderful pictures. From skippers to the merest lad pulling on whatever his mum could get for him, they come alive to us now as people with bodies, no different from ours, facing rigours far greater.
Thank you so much, and thank you so much for both of you being on here tonight. Really appreciate it, and best of luck with your book.
Thank you,
thank
Sarah.
You. Thank you for inviting us.